Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Hello and welcome to History Rage, the podcast all about members of the historical community getting angry, venting their spleen and putting the world to rights. The podcast that is therapy for historians. I'm public historian Paul Bavel and I'm here with my ever loyal co-host, fellow historian and Garum obsessive, Kyle Glover.
Hello.
So we've finally made it to episode 10, the end of series one. And although we're only going to be going away for a short time, we're leaving you now with none other than leading World War II historian, probably the most prolific author we've had on History Range so far. One half of the popular, or dare I say rival podcast, We Have Ways of Making You Talk, and director of the Chalk Valley History Festival. Ladies and gentlemen, we bring you James Holland. James, welcome to History Rage.
Good evening, boys. How are you?
We're well, thank you.
Yes, really good.
Raring to go. You feeling angry?
Oh, yeah. I've been working up to it all day.
So we've known you for a while now, but I wonder if you'd just kick things off for us by telling our listeners kind of a bit about yourself, your background, your career, and, you know, and the festival that you're now running.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've had a lot of luck my way, it has to be said. I mean, so years ago, I was working in publishing. I thought, gosh, I don't really, this is all well and good and everything and all very enjoyable, but I don't really want to live in London anymore. I actually want to live back in the country. I couldn't think what else to do. And at the time, lots of people were, lots of young folk were making sort of six-figure advances, writing what I thought was utter tosh, sort of chick lit. So I thought, well, how hard can it be? And I discovered that actually is actually quite hard. But I wrote two chick lit novels, which are wonderfully forgettable. And it sort of, you know, but it taught me how to kind of sort of write a book length. And I thought, actually, this isn't the way forward. What I really should be writing about is something that I'm really interested in. And by that stage, I've been completely kind of hooked and become properly afflicted about that endlessly fascinating subject of the Second World War. And I've been busy rushing around sort of interviewing veterans and stuff. And I sort of conceived this idea for a novel that was sort of love, loss and war, sort of sweeping kind of Birdsong meets Brideshead meets, I don't know, Battle of Britain. So I went off interviewing Battle of Britain veterans and writing this novel. And while I was doing that, I kind of discovered about the Siege of Malta. I heard about sort of Faith, Hope and Charity and the George Cross and things, but I didn't know anything about it. So I went off to try and find a book that would sort of tell me everything that I needed to know about the George Cross Island and the Siege of Malta and the Second World War. I couldn't really find one. So by that time, I rather sort of grandly had an agent. So I said to my agent, well, you know, what do you think about me doing a non-fiction book about the Siege of Malta? And it just so happened that he'd just been there. And so he was quite sort of into the whole thing. So I think that's a great idea. Go off and write a proposal. So I did. And went to great extent and kind of sort of wrote the best part of kind of 30,000 words on it, I think. And interviewed loads of people and was completely just consumed with excitement about the whole thing. And I managed to sell that, give up the day job, move to the country. And, you know, here I am kind of 20 years later.
Yeah.
With an unhealthy number of books behind me. And, you know, one thing leads to another. You know, the sort of the book sort of led to the opportunity of doing telly. And so then you do that. And then, you know, I was living down here and we were trying to raise money for our local cricket club. And one of my neighbours was James Hennage. He used to run Otica's Book Chain. And I said to him, what about us doing a kind of arts festival down here to raise some money for our pavilion fund? And he said, look, you know, that's great. I'm really up for that. But you're a historian. I love history. Why don't we do a history festival? No one else is doing it. And I went, you know what? That's a really good idea. So we started off first year, 2011, at the brand new cricket ground with our kind of non-existent pavilion. And we had, I think we had 12 people, 12, it was like a literary history festival. So we had 12 talks, we had sort of, you know, nice supper in between, tent on the cricket ground and all that kind of stuff. And we had Michael Woods and various other sort of grandees. I think Mike's the only one who'd been literally to every single festival. And it kind of grew from there. And then the next year we kind of thought, well, let's go up a bit. And I remember that we had this little committee, and it was all a bit kind of sort of Vicar of Dibley-ish, really, sitting around the table.
Yeah, as committees are.
I've had an idea. What about some living history at next year's History Festival? I remember there was just sort of absolute hilarity, and it kind of took people about 5 minutes to recover from their mirth after this outrageous suggestion. But actually, credit where credit's due, James said, do you know what? Actually, I think Jim's got a point here. And I had recently seen Dave Allen do his skit as a Agincourt longbowman, and had been mightily impressed by this. And the other person was Gary Wise, being a First World War Tommy.
Yeah.
I thought, you know what, this stuff is really good. You know, and I remember I used to go and see sort of Sealed Knot battles when I was a kid with my brother and my dad. And you know, they were huge affairs. They had sort of thousands of people, huge encampments and stuff. And they were really brilliant. And anyway, so cut a long story short, we did get a whole load of living historians in. We had a massive encampment that second year, 2012. And we've been growing it ever since. And I'm a big advocate of living history, particularly when it's done properly and when it's done by people who really, really care, really know what they're talking about. They really can bring history to life. So I'm a big advocate of it. And, you know, obviously it's now a central part of the Chore Valley History Festival, which should be our 12th year, but we had a year off for COVID. And actually, if I'm brutally honest, it's quite nice having a breather for 1 year.
I will say, much as I missed it, yes, not having to go and dig a corn
for year 11 in 2022. And it's amazing how quickly it comes around. But you know, podcast came out of all of this as well. So I've had a sort of rather charmed and blessed life, really.
Well, we can take a moment to move on then from charmed and blessed to, thoroughly despised. So welcome to what History Rage is pretty much all about.
Yeah.
So James, time for you to get it off your chest. What is the one thing that you just wish the wider world would just get over, would stop believing, or just leave alone?
It's people who say things like, the RAF was the last defense against the Nazi hordes in the Battle of Britain. You know, it's this idea of tiny little force, the few, kind of sort of a handful of sort of square-jawed young men with silk scarves and flying jackets defending us against the entire might of Nazi Germany. That's the thing that really, really bugs me. It's the Battle of Britain myth, Paul. it's this idea of kind of little Britain defending against the mighty Nazi Moloch. You know, that's what I can't bear. It absolutely drives me mad. You know, and the fact that it was a sort of a jolly close run thing, the narrow margin, all that kind of nonsense. It's absolute balls.
Right.
It's absolutely balls. I mean, the RAF absolutely whipped the Luftwaffe. I mean, it was a proper victory. And you know, the truth of the matter is, the RAF was the first line of defence, not the last line of defence. It was the first line of defense, and you know, it's Spitfires and Hurricanes, and it's ignoring Bomber Command, and it's ignoring Coastal Command, and it's ignoring the fact that actually Britain is the world's biggest empire ever, and has unbelievable global reach, that the Navy is the senior service for a reason. It's the world's largest navy, the world's largest merchant navy. There's so many things in Britain's favour. And actually, the teeniest bit of Britain's armed forces was its army at Dunkirk. And OK, so fine, they had to leave all their equipment behind, and that was a bit of a downer. And France was defeated. But this idea that Britain was totally staring down the battle, the closest Britain got was Monday, the 27th of May, 1940, when everyone was having a bit of a panic on, and Lord Halifax, who was the most respected politician in the country, was having a bit of a spat with Winston Churchill, who was brand new to the job of Prime Minister, only became Prime Minister on the 10th of May, the same day that Germany launched its blitzkrieg through into the West, its attack on the West. And at that point, it did all look a bit suspect, and everyone was totally discombobulated and freaked out by what had happened on the continent. Mm. It was the strategic earthquake absolutely no question about it. And so everyone was a bit like rabbits in headlights. They just didn't know what to think, didn't know what to do. And it was sort of, we're all going, you know, this is all going out terribly wrong, you know, and there's panic going on. And actually what it needed was cool heads and everyone to go, just calm down. It's okay. You know, we've still got the world's largest Navy, got burgeoning Air Force. We've got lots of, you know, we've got these huge dominions and empire forces and these huge, you know, huge access to the world's resources and the world's oceans and all this sort of stuff. We've got lots in our favor. We just need to keep our calm and we'll be fine.
It's not like Britain was stood alone.
On that day, Monday, the 27th of May, 1940, so the point I'm trying to make is, had Britain kind of sued for peace then, it would have been an entirely unnecessary and self-inflicted kind of defeat. You know, it was not required. Unfortunately, Churchill prevailed in his spat with Halifax. Halifax did not resign. The government wasn't brought down. Churchill kind of won further support, got everyone behind him, and, you know, the rest is history, so to speak. But that was the closest they came. It was not from the threat of Adler Targ and the Adler Angriff, you know, i.e. the attack of the Eagles, the attack of the Luftwaffe in the Battle of Britain.
Yeah.
That's what really bugs me. Grr.
Thank you. Yes. Do you feel better now?
Yeah, God, that was really good to get that off my chest. Thanks, guys.
So why do people believe this? Why do we have this mythology of the great big last stand of the RAF fighting to the last for literally for Britain? Where does this come from?
Well, I think it's a sort of a myth that sort of emerged at the time, actually. You know, there was this very famous cartoon in the Daily Express, which was a really fine newspaper back then, and was the most read paper in the UK. It was by David Lowe, and it had this picture of this Tommy kind of sort of, you know, standing on England, and there was the continent with a kind of big swastika all over it. And he's putting his fist to the sky, and he goes, "Very well, then, alone." And that's on the 18th of June, 1940. And I think it's sort of that myth started then, really. And I think there is this sort of myth of the Blitz as well, this idea that we're sort of backs to the wall. And I think there is a sort of, I think it sort of gets, it's sort of, you know, you see it in Dad's Army, this idea that we're all a bit bumbling, you know, the Home Guard sort of Captain Mannering types, you know, that sort of appeals to our sort of slightly, you know, we definitely have a sort of self-deprecating sense of humour, and we have a sort of, and we have a kind of eyebrow raised kind of sort of approach to central authority, I think. Yeah. A kind of, you know, we generally toe the line, but we're also kind of sort of, it'll all end, you know, we've got this sort of slightly kind of sort of Eeyore-ish kind of lugubriousness when it comes to kind of expectation.
Yeah, we will put up with quite a lot.
Yeah, and then there's all the kind of sort of, you know, then there's a never has been so so much owed to so by so many to so few speech, which actually does include Bomber Command and the whole of the RAF and Coastal Command, but it's sort of taken to mean the fighter pilots, because of course they're the visible ones, because, you know, when you look up, you know, you're sort of putting out your washing in a village in Kent, and you look up, what you see is little sort of Spitfires and Hurricanes sort of darting about the sky. You don't see sort of bombers going off to kind of Germany or to the airfields of northern France. So I suppose that's also part of it. And then there's just then there's the narrative of it, you know. And so I blame historians, and I also blame pilots in the Battle of Britain, you know, because they're writing their memoirs, they're being asked about their stuff, they're incredibly glamorous. And there's all sorts of sort of, well, there was me and kind of Bob and two others, and we were attacking a swarm of kind of, you know, of 300. And so this sort of perpetuates the kind of the idea that there weren't very many Spitfires and Hurricanes. And of course, what one has to remember is that Bob and Charlie are one and two of 12 in a squadron, attacking 300. But what they don't realise is all the other squadrons that are involved, of which equally make up hundreds. And one of the good things about the Battle of Britain, from the RAS point of view, is that those airfields are spread all over the place, which is in sharp contrast to those of the fighter squadrons of the Luftwaffe, which, because they're on the attack and because they've got to get across the channel before they can do any damage at all, they've all got to be as close to England as they possibly can be, which means putting them in a massive collection, either in Normandy or in the Pas de Calais.
Yeah, something that Bomber Command would find very tempting.
Which Bomber Command do find very tempting. So tempting, in fact, that they're bombing them almost every single day, much to their annoyance. And so the Pas de Calais becomes a kind of target-rich environment, to use a modern term, in a way that fighter command airfields are not, because they're quite understandably spread all over the place. But what that does mean is that you've never got more than three squadrons operating out of one sector station. And when you take off, well into September 1940, squadrons were operating on their own, and then they were operating in pairs. But again, once you were airborne, you were operating as a squadron, not in that pair. So, you know, you as a fighter pilot thinks you're one of 12, and you can be forgiven for thinking that you're the only 12 in the sky that are defending Britain. And that's where that myth perpetuates from. And I remember very well talking to Jeff and him saying, Jeff Wellham, and him saying, well, you know, you know, I can tell you, James, it was a bloody close run thing. And you tell me what it's like being, you know, me and Brian Kinkham flying into a formation of 200. I can tell you, you felt pretty outnumbered and pretty let down by the air ministry. And it's like, yeah, but Jeff, actually, you know, who else was flying that day, you know? And you know, the greatest will in the world, you know, obviously Jeff is a total legend and a lovely bloke, and I loved him dearly, and he was a great mate, and you know, it's very hard to kind of disagree with someone who was actually there at the time. You know, they were there. Yeah. But they don't have the perspective that someone does who's studying it in intimate detail 70 years later has.
Yeah. With access to paperwork and documents and stuff like that, yes.
Yeah, all those reasons and the blip, you know, the myth of the Blitz, and you know what you find is people in the retelling start adopting the kind of the memes that come out of those people. So the whole story becomes sort of self-perpetuating, and then you get sort of, you know, jigsaw puzzles with sort of, you know, a Spitfire kind of flying over a Messerschmitt and white cliffs, and it's constantly sunny, and up above are a kind of sort of huge swarm of kind of, I don't know, Heinkel 111s or something. You know, on your chocolate box or your kind of sort of box of shortbread from Kent. And you know, all that does is again, just sort of perpetuates it. And every time someone interviews a Battle of Britain veteran, they go, well, it was a close run thing. You know, we were absolutely staring down a barrel by September. And you sort of go, well, you know, were you? And I would argue not. But you know, but I'm not going to diss a Battle of Britain veteran. And I'm not going to, you know, but I think you can kind of look at things afresh, and I don't think you're offering any disrespect at all to what they did or casting doubt on their courage or what it felt like to be one of two Spitfires flying into formation of 200. Of course, I wouldn't want to do it. And you know, I am in awe of those people. But I also think it's really, really important to kind of present as objective a view of history as you possibly can. Otherwise, what's the point of being a historian?
That one man in that one plane, it was bloody scary and a bloody dangerous mission, but there were another 100-odd of his mates behind him that he didn't really see. Is that the gist of the point?
Yeah, all right. Well, let me give you an example of this. Okay, so you start off in July. July 1940 is when the Channel attacks coming across. And this is not fighting over England at this point. This is fighting over the Channel. Occasionally it's veering into southern England, and Dowding, who is the Air Chief Marshal, Commander-in-Chief of Fighter Command, has made it absolutely clear that that his pilots are not to follow the Germans out over the sea. Fly over England, because if you get shot down, then you can bail out, and you can bail out over on your own territory. Mm. Whereas if you bail out over the sea, chances are you're going to be lost forever, because you're a pinprick in a very large blue wobbly thing. And it's hard to kind of pick you out. So July is scrappy and not really the main event. The main event doesn't really start to take place until the 13th of August, although there is a major attacks on the coastal areas and radar stations and Portsmouth on the 12th of August, 1940. So let's just stick with the official kind of version that the Battle of Britain starts on the 10th of July, 1940, albeit that it's a scrappy sort of, you know, canal camp bit of it, you know, the Channel scraps. At that point, RAF Fighter Command has got about 640 daily aircraft that it can use at any one time. The Luftwaffe has got about 700 plus single engine fighters, maybe 300 twin engine fighters. It's got about 400 Stukas and maybe another kind of 1400 bombers. So on the face of it, you know, overwhelming. But what you're talking about, the way it's sort of the RAF was overwhelmed. Well, Fighter Command was outnumbered, but not quite so outnumbered if you add the kind of sort of 500 bombers of Bomber Command and the kind of 400 planes of Coastal Command. Then it's more like a kind of 2-to-1 advantage rather than a 3 or 4-to-1 advantage. And a 2-to-1 advantage is not a great advantage if you're attacking.
Yes.
You know, the rule of thumb is 3-to-1 at least. You know, by the time Russia's, you know, the Soviet Union is doing their Red Army, doing their big attacks in 1944, it's more like 40-to-1 or certainly kind of, you know, 10-to-1.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of overwhelming kind of advantage that you really, really want. And the Germans just don't have that. By the end of the Battle of Britain, RAF Fighter Command has about 750, 760 single engine fighters. The Luftwaffe is lucky if it's got less than 200. You know, so the graph has really gone down for the Luftwaffe, and it's gone gradually but steadily up, despite the losses for RAF Fighter Command. You know, in July 1940, RAF Fighter Command is receiving 440 brand new Spitfires and Hurricanes. The Luftwaffe was receiving 220 Messerschmitt 109s, which is obviously the main opponent. That is the best the ratio gets in 1940 in terms of aircraft production. So, you know, the Germans are producing less than half, you know. So first of all, British aircraft production is better than German aircraft production at that time. And the figures are just starting to turn. The second thing is this whole thing of kind of sort of, you know, we were really, you know, and part of the myth thing, I think, is perpetuated by Dowding and Park. And even in the 1960s, Park is interviewed and sort of going, well, we were really staring down the barrel. We were really worried about less about aircraft production. We were worried about the number of pilots. And we were going downhill. There's no question about it. You know, we had only 75% strength in our frontline squadrons by the beginning of September. But even that needs a little bit of examining, you know, because what does that mean, 75% strength? Okay, what that means is about 16 to 18 pilots rather than 22 or 24, because actually, although you would only have, you'd never have more than 12 in the air at any one time, there was a kind of sort of almost 2-to-1 of, you know, doubling over of pilots and aircraft in a squadron to get 12 airborne. And that's so that, you know, that's Dowding was very keen on that because he didn't want people overflying, getting overexhausted mentally and physically. And he was absolutely bang on about that. So being 75% strength is still, you know, you've still got more than you need to get 12 airborne.
Yeah. Still operational.
You're still operational all the time. And actually, they find a very, very good solution, which is the ABC method, which is introduced by Park on Saturday, the 7th of September. And that's where you have you categorize your squadron so that A squadrons are fully experienced pilots, B squadron are sort of, you know, half experienced, half greenhorns, and a C squadron is, you know, maybe 4 experienced and the rest are greenhorns. And a C squadron would be in Accrington or Drem or somewhere in Pembrey in Wales or somewhere where they might see a bit of action, but hardly any, but where they can build up, you know, people coming straight from the operational training units where they've had to cut the amount of training at the operational training unit, which is the last stage before you join a squadron, where, you know, there's no shortage of fuel or anything like that. They can build up their hours, learn from the pros who've already been there and done it, got the T-shirt. And when they're sufficiently ready, then they can switch and move down to a Category A or a Category B, which is an incredibly sensible solution, saved lots of young people's lives. So the idea that people were going to frontline squadrons with just 15 hours in their logbooks is also absolute total rubbish. You know, no one would be going to a frontline squadron with anything less than 150 hours, at least, in their logbook. When they're talking about joining a frontline squadron with 10 or 15 hours, that's on type, i.e. 10 or 15 hours on a Spitfire or a Hurricane. But
yeah,
people who were being sent to a frontline squadron with just that weren't being put into the fray. I mean, you know, no squadron leader would send them up with that small amount of time because it was completely counterproductive. You know, they were going to be hindrance, not a help. So they would hang around the squadron until they'd got some experience. That whole thing was a very brief window anyway, because on the 7th of September, Park introduced the ABC classification, and that solved that problem in a trice. So from then on, anyone who was coming straight out of OTU with only 10 or 15 hours on their Spitfire Hurricanes was sent straight to a Category C until they got their hours up.
Yeah.
And so that whole thing, that is also just a total myth. Then you get to kind of situations, you know, where they're completely outnumbered. I mean, throughout July and particularly throughout the first 3 weeks of August, I mean, the middle weeks of August, rather, you had lots of different raids of Luftwaffe raids going all over the place, attacking multiple airfields at multiple times. Their idea was to try and destroy the RAF on the ground. They didn't realize that we had this huge fully coordinated air defense system. So what had worked in the past in Poland and in France and the Low Countries suddenly wasn't working. Because the whole USP of that was that you pounce when they don't know and you catch them on the ground and you destroy them on the ground. That wasn't happening because we knew when they were coming so we could get airborne. So we weren't on the ground. So you get everyone airborne or hide your Spitfires, you know, out of the way. And that was incredibly successful. But so what you were having was smaller raids of maybe, I don't know, kind of 10 or 15 bombers escorted by, you know, perhaps the same again or double. And you'd be intercepted by variously three squadrons, something like that. So, you know, again, it's not overwhelming superiority. Until September that you get these large scale formations, and they're all going to basically to London for the most part. You know, these huge formations of, you know, 100 plus, 150, 200, 300, something like that. But at that time, you know, OK, the classic example is Sunday, the 15th of September, which is now commemorated as Battle of Britain Day. There's two major raids that day. First one peaks at about midday, attack on southeast London. And that is a raid of about 100 enemy aircraft, of which 25 only are Dornier 17 bombers. And the other 75 are escorts of Messerschmitt 109 single engine fighters and Messerschmitt 110 double engine fighters. To meet them are 285 Spitfires and Hurricanes. Okay, so they don't even have, you know, they're attacking with an almost 3-1 disadvantage. And then you have the biggie, which is the kind of peaking at 3 o'clock in the afternoon raid, which is the big one on southeast London, where the big wing is bought up and comes a little bit late to the battle, but it's another old 50 Spitfires and Hurricanes attacking the Luftwaffe. Anyway, that one, that is about 300 enemy aircraft, of which 100 only are bombers, mixture of Heinkels, Junkers 88s and Dornier 17s, and escorted by 200 fighter escorts, attacked by 335 Spitfires and Hurricanes. And of course, again, part of the myth, and this backs to the wall thing, is Churchill's own memoirs, because he goes to Uxbridge, he goes and sees which is headquarters of 11 Group, which is the whole southeast of England, and he goes down the steps, down into the bunker, down into the kind of, you know, control room, sees Park there, chats to Park with his unlit cigar, because he's not allowed his cigar in there because it will muck up the air filter system, and he turns to Park and says, "Where are all the reserves?" And Park looks at him and goes, "There are none." And the way it's always translated is terribly somber, backs to the wall. This was the last throw of the dice. You know, if this wasn't going to work, we were stuffed. But we don't know what tone of voice Park says. We don't know what Park said after that.
It could have been, "We don't need any."
Yes. We don't know that he didn't say, "Well, I've got everyone in. There are none in 11 Group, because I've made the tactical decision to employ them all at this one moment. So we have an overwhelming attack peppering the enemy attack. And these are the tactics that I've changed and I think is best suited to the moment. However, when I say there are none, I'm not including the other 400 elsewhere in the country."
If I can cut in with a question of just permit me clinging to the myth with my last kind of dying breath there. But yeah, I accept Britain didn't stand alone. It did stand cut off from its empire. We had been unceremoniously booted out of France. You know, was there a distinct disadvantage that we faced? You know, were there any overwhelming odds that we actually did beat?
Well, I suppose psychologically, it was a strategic earthquake that France was rolled over in, you know, effectively 5 days, which is what it was. You know, the collapse of the Meuse front was basically it. And at that point, there was no realistic chance of turning it around. And that was because the Germans were able to take off the French in penny packets and surround them piecemeal rather than allow the French to concentrate en masse, which would have made them impregnable. And that was all about comms and all the rest of it. So there was no question that that was a massive strategic earthquake. But the very nature of Britain's being separate from the continent was absolutely its impregnable advantage. Because defending it was the world's largest navy, you know, which was at the same time also cutting off Germany from the outside world. So if anyone was isolated, it was Germany, yeah. despite the fact that they'd marched into kind of, you know, Scandinavia and the Low Countries and France. And Britain still has access to the world's oceans. It still has enormous clout. You know, it is not the little Britain that, that it became or has become or is about to become even more little in recent times. You know, it was the biggest empire the world has ever known in terms of kind of, you know, geographical pinkness, yeah. for want of yeah. a better phrase. And that is a huge advantage. And the bottom line is the Germans were trying to cow Britain into an early peace settlement. And they were looking at it through the prism of their own worldview, which is we're a continental power. The army is everything. When you lose your army, that is like the biggest disaster ever. And so therefore, of course, Britain's going to come to terms, because what else can it do? It's, you know, Germany's completely failing to appreciate what Britain's strategic strengths are. Germany is all about winning wars incredibly quickly. Historically, it always has done. It's not, what it can't do is afford yeah. a long, drawn-out attritional war, because it's always going to lose, because it's stuck in the middle of Europe and doesn't have access to the world's resources. You know, and that's why it loses in the First World War, because it's affecting a lightning strike in August 1914 and then gets bogged down in sticky attritional warfare and loses. You know, and it's going to lose again if it doesn't win in the summer of 1940, almost certain.
It's like Blitzkrieg's nothing new.
Blitzkrieg's nothing new. It's an age-old thing that goes all the way back beyond Frederick the Great to Frederick the Elector. I mean, and out of necessity. Whereas Britain can, as long as it holds off initially, and that means resisting an invasion attempt and keeping the Luftwaffe at bay, it's going to be fine. And keeping the Luftwaffe at bay is odds on it's going to work, because it's got the world's first fully coordinated air defence system, which no other country's ever had and which is spectacularly efficient. And secondly, it's got the world's largest navy. And Germany doesn't have a strategic air force, which is what it needs for such an air attack. You know, the Luftwaffe is what we would call a tactical air force, close air support. It is designed and has grown up organically to support ground forces. Suddenly, it's been given a completely different role for which it has not trained and is not suited. It's not equipped. Doesn't have kind of, there's no radio connection. There's no ground controllers. They're not mm-hmm. using radar, all sorts of things. It's just not prepped for. They don't have any heavy bombers. The amount of ordnance they're dropping is pathetic compared to what's going to come later on in the war. They just haven't thought it through. Their intelligence on Britain is absolutely woeful. Their aircraft production is just risible. You know, there is nothing about the Luftwaffe setup in 1940 that suggests it can overwhelm the RAF. So that's first big problem. The second problem is they don't have any landing craft. They've never done an amphibious invasion before. They're a continental land power, which is unused to doing these sort of things. They haven't practiced for it, haven't really trained for it, apart from sort of a bit of last-minute training. And they don't have any means of getting their army across, effective means, I should say, of getting their army across the channel. And they get across a channel which is absolutely swimming with British mines and is defended by the world's most powerful navy. You know, it's just not going to happen. The arch gambler Hitler will not risk his forces going across the channel when even the most basic criteria of launching an attack, which is to clear the skies and have air superiority, at least over the area of the invasion, has not been met and has absolutely no signs of being met.
I suppose there's a case to say, I mean, this is a man, you say the gambler who won't risk invading England. This is a man that risked invading the Soviet Union.
Yes, he risked frankly going
into Poland. But wouldn't risk invading England.
He's not shy of gambling, but he won't gamble on this one because even for him, it's absolutely harebrained. It's just not going to happen. And that's before you start talking about Coastal Command and Bomber Command, who are bombing Germany, bombing Berlin, bombing, okay, admittedly not very effectively, but they are. And they're also bombing continental ports where all these Rhine River barges are being massed. You know, the whole thing's that, you know, it is absurd. But the reason we win the Battle of Britain, Britain wins the Battle of Britain, is because it's really good. you know, it's not designed to have a big army and fight a big continental land war. So, you know, obviously there's some shortcomings there, although actually the BEF fights incredibly well, I think, really, all things considered. I mean, what do you do when you kind of, the people either side on either flank of you are pulling back? You don't have any much choice in the matter, do you? But actually where they are engaged, they fight very, very well and effectively and actually quite often give the Germans a bloody nose. I'm thinking about, the Grenadiers at the Esko. I'm thinking about the counterattack at Arras, you know, those absolutely crappy Matilda ones. They still managed to, you know, really put the heebie-jeebies up Rommel's 7th Panzer Division, so much so that the halt order can be absolutely directly go back. The heritage of that halt order, which is effectively what saves the BEF, can go right back to the counterattacking Arras on the 21st of May. So actually the BEF do quite well. But that's an aside. You know, the BEF is 10 divisions, French divisions 105, I think Belgium's 20, Dutch are 15. You know, so the British Army is tiny at that point. So although that bit doesn't go well, the rest of Britain's armed forces are actually in decent nick at that point. And the two bits that really count for 1940, the Navy and the RAF, are in, you know, they're in good fettle and more than prove their worth. And you cannot underestimate what a force multiplier the air defence system of Britain is. I mean, that just changes everything. That puts you from, instead of being on a kind of massive disadvantage, and okay, we haven't got quite as many fighter planes defending us as the Luftwaffe have got attacking us, but you might as well times them by three by virtue of the fact you've got the air defence system. Because it's just, you know, it's just not penetrated effectively by the Luftwaffe. And out of the 138 airfields, I think it is, that the RAF has in Britain in 1940, only one is knocked out for more than 48 hours. And okay, Biggin Hill is knocked about and all the rest of it, but it's never out of action for more than a few hours at a time. And because the defences have been so carefully prepared, what you've got is extra control rooms 3 miles down the road. And they just sort of, you know, get into their Humbers and off they go and you know, out there.
Yeah. They were set up in tea rooms, church halls, anything that would give it a go, which is the British improvised way.
But really, the idea that it's just the few and we were on, you know, we were backs to the wall and it was the last chance saloon and all this stuff, it's just not true. And actually what should be celebrated is how well organised we were, how brilliant the air defence system was, and how absolutely thoroughly whipped the German Luftwaffe was in the Battle of Britain.
Was there any part of Operation Sea Lion that actually looked like a good idea?
No. I can answer that one.
My favourite bit of the Operation Sea Lion idea is the fact they don't have enough motorised barges. They don't have any landing craft at all, apart from these little rafts that they send over, these little sort of ferries, which can take a few things. But they don't really have bows, and they're just... I can't remember what the name of them is, but they're just totally ill-suited to crossing the Channel. They're fine on the Straits of Messina, which is about a mile and a half wide and quite sheltered, but in the Mediterranean, but won't work across the Channel at all. But then my favourite bit is that they plan to have one motorised barge towing two unmotorised barges. So how's that going to work?
Now, I've sailed. That's not going to work at all.
It's not going to work.
And just that compared to what the Allies came up with and invented almost from scratch to go the other way,
yeah,
and that was still a hairy, dangerous mission.
Exactly, Carl. Exactly.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. It just can't happen.
Not going to happen. Not on a whole millennium of Sundays. Not a chance. I still think the Battle of Britain was one of the great strategic turning points in the Second World War, because the moment the Britons carry on fighting, Hitler has to think of another solution, because with Britain fighting, he's you know, waiting in the wings as the United States. While Britain's in the war, he's in trouble, because he knows that Britain's only going to get stronger. You know, it might be a little bit, Britain might be a little bit behind the game in terms of kind of tank production and aircraft production and all the rest of it compared to the Luftwaffe, which started early, but it's soon going to be able to outproduce Germany, and then Germany's going to be stuffed. So what do you do? Well, you know, you have to go into the Soviet Union earlier than planned. I mean, it was always the German idea to go into the Soviet Union. That was always their intention. But they go in earlier than planned and with catastrophically disastrous results. You know, so much so that I think by the end of 1941, there is absolutely no way back for the Germans, really. There's still sort of moments of jeopardy, but there's no chance of turning it around.
Yeah, from 1941 onwards, the whole project is pretty much doomed. It's just a question of when. rather than the myth.
The Soviet Union might still have, might have folded in the summer of 1942, but I think it's unlikely. Not least because most of their factories were already moved behind the Urals, and the Germans' next kind of target was not Moscow; it was the oil fields of Baku, which they desperately needed because they didn't have enough oil. And they go down to Baku, and it's absolutely inconceivable that the Red Army wouldn't have destroyed them before the Germans got there, had the Germans threatened them. And even if the Germans had got there and the Soviet Union had destroyed their own oil fields, the Germans had no means of actually transporting that oil. So nothing was completely pointless. I mean...
Oh, they've got loads of little barges that they could tend up the river that they weren't using to invade Britain.
I mean, things go around the world in 1941 and 42 by ship, just as they do today. And if you don't have any shipping, you're a bit stuffed. And the Germans don't have any shipping. They don't have any, So I just can't see how it could have worked. So consequently... Not defeating Britain in 1940 is the big strategic turning point of the entire war.
So just how much is actually owed to so many by...
Well, a huge amount is owed to the few, definitely. But I would say the few are still are still Bomber Command and Coastal Command as well. I think you have to think of the RAF as a sort of combined package in 1940. And it's the whole effort, not least because Bomber Command are going over and hitting that target-rich environment in Calais, for example. And to deal with that, because they don't have any radar and they don't have any kind of ground control, really, they've got to keep two fighter planes back for airfield defence every time their squadron goes off, which is annoying for them, and means there's fewer planes going over to Britain, which is a good thing. So they're also playing their part just on that alone.
A German plane knocked out by a bomber from Bomber Command is just as knocked out as a plane heroically shot down in a dogfight
I would say so. But there is absolutely no question that the Battle of Britain is a very visible thing. People were watching it playing out. It seemed incredibly scary when lots of bombers were coming over, and I totally get that. And these were the guys who were kind of sort of putting their necks on the line and going up and flying every single day and defending us. And it gave the country self-belief. It gave the world a sense of, a sort of visible sense of defiance. Lots of American observers came over and went, yeehaw, these plucky limeys and all this kind of stuff. So, absolutely, it was a vitally important battle to win. Without the people going up there and flying in the Spitfires and Hurricanes, he wouldn't have been able to do it. So, absolutely, a lot is owed. But I think also there's quite a lot that were owed to the many as well. All the ground crews, the people at aircraft production, the people running the show, the control rooms, the observer corps, radar, manning the radar stations and all the rest of it. It's a bigger effort. But I think a huge amount is owed to the few. Yeah, definitely.
Brilliant. So, well, I've now just finished your latest book, Brothers in Arms, Moving from Planes to Tanks. Have to say, loved it. I very much like that kind of small scale where you can follow the people first. This is why I really liked Burma. What's the next project on the cards for you then? Because I know, I've seen you do about a book a year at the moment.
Yeah, I'm not doing that.
What's coming next? At the moment.
So that's good. And I'm really, really enjoying that. Going back to that, I haven't done any for a while. So that's been really good fun. Next non-fiction book is going to be Westwall, which will be back more sort of campaigny, I suppose. And that's going to be the last sort of 8 months of the war from the beginning of October 1944 through to May 1945. And it's just that bit that people just don't really know so much about, really, I don't think. It's the Rhine crossings, it's the Bulge, it's all that kind of stuff. It's Operation Veritable. It's that big sort of murky winter, which is incredibly difficult, incredibly costly in terms of casualties, and was absolutely brutal, but gets forgotten about a bit, really, but is still absolutely full of human drama. And of course, you've got lots of air operations going on as well. And so it'll be lots of stuff about the bombing. It'll be the whole effort and what's going on in Japan and blah, blah, blah. So it'll be a bit more of a big sort of sweeping one, but I hope it'll hit the spot as well.
Yeah, complete the trilogy.
Excellent. Excellent, excellent. Is the fiction another Jack Tanner novel?
Well, I've done about 82,000 words of a novel, which I started last summer, which I really enjoyed, which is a sort of big sweeping family saga set on a farm, but over three generations. So it's sort of Downton Abbey meets Band of Brothers, I would say.
I'd pay to see that.
Amazing, yes, excellent.
The third generation, they do all go off to war, and unlike Downton Abbey, where you basically, with a few exceptions, you basically stay at Downton, you know, Highclere Castle, you do follow the various people where they go off to the war, and, you know, of course, there's someone who ends up in Dunkirk, there's someone who's on a ship in Norway, there's another one who's a Spitfire pilot in the Battle of Britain, all this sort of stuff. So you know, you get the full gamut. And there's one of the daughters is a secretary to Hastings Ismay, which enables me to kind of talk about, explain what's going on in the war. But also, I'm very interested in the kind of sort of transition in farming and the huge agricultural revolution that took place in the World War. You know, yes. This idea that Britain's producing 14% of its own food in 1939, but 91% by 1945, which I think is remarkable and an incredible transformation of which the tentacles are still being felt to this day. And I felt that was worth charting as well in some detail.
Yeah, that's as much a part of the story as anything else.
At the same time, I might have to put that on hold sort of halfway through the first one, because there is talk about doing a Jack Tannell, and we're kind of just testing the water at the moment, and they're reissuing the old ones and giving them new jackets and a makeover and that kind of stuff. But I have been working up a plot for Jack Tannell in Normandy.
I'll confess I haven't read any of those.
Well, you're really in for a treat. That's all
you should. Yeah. Yes, you should. Treat.
Thank you very much, James. You know, I think we feel thoroughly told now. I mean, I'd pretty much already bought into that Last Stand idea before, and now I know damn well better.
Well, there you go.
So,
thank you very much for inviting on. I feel very honoured.
Absolutely welcome. If you'd like to know more about James, then you can read the multitude of books that James has produced. You can hear him speak at most of the country's leading history festivals, not least of which the Chalk Rally History Festival. You can follow him on Twitter at James1940. Warfestify, we're going to let you plug that when all our listeners come and tune into We Have Ways of Making You Talk. But James, it's been an absolute blast. So thank you very much for coming.
No, thank you for inviting me. It's been great fun. And good to see you, boys.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. You can follow us on Twitter at History Rage, or individually, I am at Paul Bavel.
And I'm at Kyle G. History.
And you can leave comments, thoughts, and please send your own History Rages, because we want to know what you wish people would just stop believing. And you can use the hashtag History Rage. If you've enjoyed our work, then please subscribe. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Podchaser, or wherever you get your podcasts. It really means a lot when you do that. Thanks a lot for listening from all of us at History Rage. Thank you for staying with us through season one. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll see you in 4 weeks' time. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's AURA.com/safety.